Hello, and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join Jack Stafford and Deborah Littleboy, members of the Aetherius Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, and mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the selfsame quest for truth. Please note this is an independent program not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, our guest is Richard Hoffman. Hello, Rich.
Hi, how are you?
Good to be here. Very well, thank you. Really pleased to connect with you. You've been in the UFO game for, is it 50 years now?
Well, next year will be my 60th year. So it's six decades. I got started in 1964.
Do you think you see some of the same craft flying around? The same, you know, they're coming, could be the same guys going over and back over and over again? Or?
Let me put it to you this way. Anything is possible in this whole field. You literally have so much variation, though, in terms of craft. And even, you know, reports of occupants that it just makes your head spin. It makes like, you know, do we ever, you know, it's like, you know, it would be nice if you could figure out, well, this is the Chevy Volta, you know, model or, you know, but you just can't get to that point because all of them are so varied. And, you know, our ability to be able to describe them is also, you know, a challenge, you know, trying to take human testimony and have it make sense many times is often difficult. I've had cases where I've investigated 30 witnesses, like back in the 70s, where all 30 of them kind of drew something different that they had seen and all picked up on something, you know, little nuances here and there that they had, which differentiated from, you know, the other 29. So this is one of the challenges we have. And this is why science is really needed to be able to help us to get to understand them better.
Yeah, well, that's why I love what you're doing with this scientific coalition for UAP studies, the SCU. You've really identified the need, I believe, that scientists need to get interested in UFOs. We need to bring in their expertise. And that's the particular angle that you're pushing and pushing very well.
Thank you very much. This has been a long, interesting journey over that six decades that I'm talking about. You know, I was a naive 13-year-old and propelled into it living in Dayton, Ohio, which is where Project Blue Book was. Many cases that I got investigated had a Blue Book officer sitting next to me, and he was doing the same interview. And then I got connected to the people at the base, and, you know, I was on Phil Donahue at age 15, and then suddenly propelled into, like, well, this is a UFO guy in Dayton, you know, you need to go to him. And it just, you know, it changed my entire life, you know, my whole perspective on things. You know, I'll also point out to you the fact that, you know, it seems when you announce that you're into UFOs, so suddenly you thought, well, I'll report my Bigfoot case to him. I'll report my ghost case to him. I'm saying, like, well, wait a minute, I can't be a master of everything. You know, I need to focus in on one specific thing and really see if I can get, you know, some understanding behind it, right?
Yes, and huge.
So I chose the UFO thing, and I, even to this day, when somebody calls, you know, or says that they had a Bigfoot thing, I said, well, I know a great Bigfoot guy that you need to go to, right? You know, or I've got some other person, you need to go and talk to this individual. And But I pretty much have stayed with UFO phenomena over those decades. I've investigated probably well over 1,000 cases firsthand, you know, being dragged out into fields by witnesses and saying, hey, look, this is where it, you know, fell down from the sky. And, you know, so I've had a lot of tremendous experiences with that whole phenomena. And I will say this much, I have not seen a UFO myself. I have been engaged in this purely from the standpoint of, you know, number one, interest. You know, obviously curiosity is a, you know, it gets a 13-year-old engaged, and that's what happened. And then, but when you're talking with people and you're finding out what their experiences were, and you start to see that there's such a consistency in many of these things that you start to say, well, wait a minute, you know, not everybody's nuts. Not everybody is, like, you know, just hallucinating. Not everybody is doing this, that there must be something to it. And then when you take it one step further and you start looking at cases around the globe, you find out, well, it's not just in the United States, it's everywhere, you know? And it's like, well, wait a minute. Okay, then, and they're telling the same kinds of things. And so why would I, you know, say that that's not the case, or it's not real. You know, it's
but one of the questions I'm a firm believer in UFOs. I mean, you're preaching to the converted here. I'm really interested to hear what you think about Stephen Greer and his the ideas that there could be retrofitted terrestrial craft. Is that possible?
Well, I know you're talking about Greer, but I'm also talking about David Grush, who was the guy who actually came out on in hearings. David Grush was that intelligence agent that briefed the Congress and right. mentioned that the fact that they are re-engineered craft that we have in our possession. Yeah. And if you look back through the history of UFOs, you'll find that out of the, you know, probably millions of cases globally, that there have been instances where we have had people reporting crashed UFOs. If you look at Roswell in 1947, right? I mean, something allegedly crashed. Something was allegedly picked up by the military. It was carted off to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. It was, you know, some of it might have gone elsewhere, but at least it ended up. And then I'm in Dayton and I'm finding out, well, people are saying, yeah, well, we had it here, or, you know, and then you have additionally the report like the Kecksburg case in Pennsylvania was also a case where there were retrievals. And you find out that Project Moondust was a government project that the military had, which is to retrieve materials and craft, which they then bring back to engineers to have them re-engineer it and figure out how it works. In fact, you know, I work in the DOD, and right here in Huntsville, Alabama, at Redstone Arsenal, there is an organization known as the Missile Space Intelligence Center, MSIC. And MSIC's job, and I've been over there and I've seen it, is to retrieve those missiles and various things like Scuds, and they're all those kinds of things that our enemies use. And they come back and they tear them apart piece by piece and figuring out what the function is and how they work. And that's what our job is. So if you look throughout even our Earth's history, when we got Greek fire from, you know, it was probably stolen by, you know, the Trojans or somebody other, or some other, you know, and bottom line is, when you have these, you know, these takeovers by militaries or other countries and stuff like that, they often, assume the technologies that culture is using, and they use it for their advantage, right? So every government on the planet, or every military, does the same thing. So there have been alleged, maybe like as many as 200 crashes, according to Len Stringfield, which he's documented, and back in the 70s, and they're around the globe. Well, so maybe other governments have allegedly captured and retrieved them, but who is going to admit it? And you know, it's so I've always heard people admitting the fact that we had them. It's just now it's reaching public attention in the context that you've got somebody that's actually saying the same thing, you know, and are willing to go on the record to do that. So, I mean, you know, I applaud David Grush. I actually got to meet him. He was at my conference that I had here in Huntsville. You know, good for him. I'm proud of him. I know a whole bunch of other scientists who have all said that they were engaged in similar programs around, you know, recovered craft.
Mm-hmm. So some of the sightings could be terrestrial.
Well, I mean, let me put it this way. When we say that they're terrestrial, I mean, what I'm saying is that, you know, we believe that we've had in our possession some sort of craft that were physical. Okay. The question is origin, you know, and where we struggle the most is what's the origination point for these things? Even if you had a structured craft that you had retrieved, would you understand how to use it? It would be similar to me giving a Neanderthal an iPhone and saying, here, what are you going to do? And how does it work? What is it supposed to do? Would I know what to do with that advanced technology, if you would? Mm. And so we don't likely even, I mean, these things are like capable of doing things in our atmosphere that are maybe 1,000 years ahead of us. And in that being the case, we don't understand how they operate. It might be, you know, some allegedly say that they operate via the alien mind, if you would, and that they're like, you know, their controls are like that. Well, how do we replicate an alien mind to be able to make them operate, right? Mm. The best thing that we could do is be able to figure out the materials. So if you get the material, for example, in the Roswell case, you find out that, you know, the witnesses described that you could take the metal and you could bend it in your hand, and it was lightweight, and when you opened your hand, it would return to its normal shape. And then another part of that was that there was also a light material that you couldn't bend at all. You couldn't, you know, you tried to burn it, you tried to hammer it, it wouldn't bend, but it was lightweight material. And if you take a look even throughout history in terms of what's happened with that, an organization known as Battelle was working with the Air Force project at Dayton, Ohio, and they were consultants. And allegedly, Battelle played a critical role in possibly retrieving some of the material from the Roswell, right? And they funneled it out to various organizations like the Navy, the Naval Ordnance Labs, who, guess what? They made a metal that's bendable, that's lightweight, and they did the same thing in the early 60s. And it's called nitinol, which is nickel titanium. NOL is Naval Ordnance Lab, nitinol. And we now use them in our bendable glasses, by the way. That's the same. It's called shape memory alloy.
So could it come from UFO technology?
Yeah. Okay. So we reverse engineer it, and then we put it out, you know, and we use it for our advantage.
I guess they pass it because they want to keep it a secret, so they parcel up each part. And then
It's about how can you use whatever this stuff is to your advantage.
I guess you're... The thing with the UFO field is everyone's a specialist in their area, really, and they pick their niche. Am I right? You know, someone's in abduction, someone's in, you know, you're...
Yeah, without a doubt. We all can't be masters of the entire enchilada.
Yeah.
We all, like, try to focus in on our areas of expertise to see if we could advance our understanding better. So, for example, in SCU... we've got physicists who are going and trying to, like, take a look at, you know, physical effects that we've observed of the objects in water, in the air. And we're trying to say, well, can we learn anything from the physical effects that are being described? So a good example would be, like, in the Nimitz case in 2004, one of the pilots who remained up, Commander Slate remained up at the 20,000-foot level while Commander Fravor dove down after the tic-tac alleged-shaped object, right? And then they started going around a circle, and they started coming up. Well, anyway, the point is it got up to a point where Commander Slate was, and he observes that the tic-tac had some sort of a mirage-like effect around it. And that mirage-like effect could be some sort of a field that it was generating around the object that we could potentially get to understand. And there's a lot of, you know, scientists who have put papers together about using kind of like microwave kind of capabilities and into creating a vacuum in space around the craft. My one aha moment that I have, I told you about that I haven't seen a UFO. But boy, I've been around some interesting things, like a 70-foot diameter area of wheat crop that was completely gone all the way down 2 feet in the ground. No roots existed anymore. It's in the middle of the wheat field, and there was no way that anything big could come into the wheat field. There were UFO sightings the night before. The farmer allowed us to go out and do an investigation. And so you have this 70-foot area where there's no wheat. And when you go in from the center where there was a depression in the soil, you move out in any direction and you start to get on the outer perimeter and you start to find a little bit of the roots that are there. And then you see maybe a little stubble above the ground. And then you go a little bit further and now you see the wheat stem has been rotated. Something was rotating it. And then up beyond that, you had an entire 70-foot area of puffed wheat.
Wow.
So there's something that was hot, if you would, that microwave, and we found microwave radiation, by the way, But bottom line is that there was something there that baked that whole thing and even destroyed completely all of the roots down in the center part of it. And you have the puffed weed around the perimeter. And you say to yourself, well, what could possibly have done that? And, you know, your brain goes nuts because you realize whatever it had to be, it had to come from above. You know, it didn't come through the wheat field, you know, to create that effect. And this is all in the course of one evening, right? And so bottom line is that you have, that was my aha moment, that there's really something there. And then in around that same time, I also had an opportunity to go out and brief actually people at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that work in Foreign Technology Division in that area on UFOs. And then I had, you know, I said, how many people have ever, you know, seen one? And of course, like one nervous hand went up, and the room was filled with maybe like 40 or 50 people or something to that effect. And then one by one, everybody came up and started telling me their stories privately. Because nobody wants to admit publicly that they had seen it. And so consequently, then what happened was that people started telling me there. And one guy came up and said, my job was to go out and use my aircraft to chase them and film them. And then when I came back to the base, they confiscated the film and I never saw it again.
Wow. Can I jump in here just for a second?
Sure, Deborah, go right ahead. I'm sorry, I've been hogging the
time. No, absolutely not. It's just as you were speaking, my memory hooked onto something that I'd read recently. Well, I read recently from this little book here. I don't know whether you can see it. It's called The Flying Saucers, A Report on Flying Saucers, Their Crew Missions to Earth by our master, George King. And this little booklet costs 2 shillings or 5 cents. So we're talking pre-62, this book came out. And he's describing the motherships now. So if you like, what we have here is a master of yoga.
Could I just ask if you've heard of Dr. King in your 60 years? Have you already?
Yeah, I know all about him.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you got to understand that I've been around this very, very long. You know, I'm well aware of George Adamski's claims. I'm well aware of, George King. I'm aware of many other contactees and where they were going with it. And, you know, and so, yep, I'm fully aware of him. I know that he was a yoga master. I practice yoga. My wife does. And we both have been doing that for quite some time. But yeah, I mean, I know that he was channeling, I guess, is it the master? Aetherius? Is that what?
Yeah, one of the master Aetherius was one of the people who's channeling.
They had certain names, like something like signal operator or something.
Yeah, Mars Sector 6 and people like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm pretty familiar with it and him. Yes.
Well, what we also have found out since his passing is that it was an avatar from Mars. And he actually flew spaceships. Okay, so this is from somebody from the other side, if you want. So he says about a mothership, the carrier vessels are made of organic metal, which is susceptible to the concentration of thought waves emanated by their operators. This substance is thought to be self-reproducing. They are protected by a force field, which is intensified in direct relation to the velocity of the craft. This force field is magnetic in nature and causes a compass needle to oscillate and has a pronounced effect upon radio reception. I'm going to just jump on again because going back to your description of the guy up here, the guy down there, craft comes back up here. You like the way that I've been. Just put that into Janet and Jill, don't you? But anyway, so this force field reflects and refracts light and causes a fuzzy effect on photographic plates. And then it says, so that's what you've just described. What I heard. These radiations are not harmful to Earth people unless they come very near to a mothership in motion. So I just wanted to sort of pull that parallel together, because I for one like to get my information from lots of different sources and find those parallels, and if you like, see that truth comes from many different sides. And so yeah, I was quite excited. You were speaking, I think, I've read that somewhere. Which one of these books did I see that in? So yes, yeah, so forgive me for jumping in there, but just
I think to be quite honest with you, I think that when we start to look at all these parallels and these things like that, it's very, very important. I think a lot of us have known for a long time that we've always believed that there was like something like a field around the craft. I mean, it has to have that. And then also the explanations for why you can't get a clear photograph many times is because of that potential field around it that's distorting it, right? And you try to make, some sort of, and then you're exactly right in the sense that we had automobiles that were being impacted by the being in proximity to the objects, where the engines would stall and stop, and then they would start back up again, And there's people that have, had compasses and electronic equipment that have indicated that something was there. So all those things you're talking about are very consistent with the phenomena overall. Let me also back up for a second. In the early days with the whole thing, you heard often the phrase, the mothership. You might have had a cigar-shaped craft or something of that nature back in the early days, in which you would have disc-shaped objects that would come out of it or go back into it, and then it would zoom, the big one would take off, Nowadays, we don't seemingly have many descriptions of anything like a mothership per se. The objects themselves, if you take a look at the object that was the Tic Tac, we measured the speed or the velocity of that at being Mach 55. Now that's 55 times the speed of sound, right? So if you remember back in the early days, we were trying to break the sound barrier and how fast we were doing. This is now going, and so hypersonic speeds are above Mach 5. So all the things you hear about with high hypersonics is Mach 5. Well, these are Mach 55. If I take that Mach 55, if I had that craft, it's basically going at interstellar speeds. Interstellar speeds, which is what I'm trying to tell you is, from a relativistic standpoint, if I had that craft, I could be easily in another galaxy or far, far away in a matter of less than a month or something like that. Just no time at all.
Well, they can actually travel much faster than that, apparently. They can travel at this instantly.
But I'm just trying to point out that speed, that measured speed right there, that is in interstellar speed. So what I'm trying to say to you is also, as we increase our speed toward the speed of light, time slows down for me if I were on board the craft. So I would only be gone a month. However, with time, the time phenomena that we know of, Earth time would have advanced maybe 1,000 years. So that's where we struggle with the whole notion about, people coming from, potentially they would have to become more like nomadic, in the sense that if, let's say, we had an intelligence coming here from another planet, and they were using these kind of craft, then it would be a situation where potentially they could, what I'm trying to say is that they would be like nomads. They would come here and stay here.
Well, in the Aetherius Society, we're firm believers in the multiverse, that there are many octaves of manifestation, and that's why they disappear out. So all the other planets in our galaxy are habited just at different frequency, a much higher frequency. And we're at one frequency. That's why all the other planets are empty for us.
Yeah, so going back to that for a second. So like we have a situation where, for example, there's multiple hypotheses about where the origination is from. You have some craft that are out there that can go and they, we call them cloaking, if you would, or they kind of disappear in front of the person. Or they appear
to a different frequency, yeah.
Or they appear out of nowhere. You know, whatever it is, if it's frequency, whether it's just the fact that they have a cloaking capability, we really don't know. I mean, I'm not been aboard the craft to say that it's doing something different. It just, its visibility somehow, it becomes visible and then it dissipates and it goes away. So if you look at the case up in the Alaska JAL aircraft, the Alaska case where you had an object the size of an aircraft carrier that appears in front of a cargo aircraft. And it's now being picked up on two radar stations. Two separate radar stations are detecting it, which means that it's physical now at this point. It's being picked up. And you get a radar return because it is physically there. So you have a situation where, and then it goes away and it's not being picked up at all. So the question is, where did it go? Could that be interdimensional that we're talking about? Then at the same time, you have, if you look at the descriptions of the beings, I mean, they're everything from dwarves to giants to robots to you name it. I mean, they're as varied as the day is day. I mean, but there's a commonality. A lot of them are talked about as being short or tiny, small, you know, diminutive, if you would. And those, a lot of times it's become the lexicon that they have the large eyes. They have a very small slit that they don't speak from. They use their minds to communicate. They don't have apparently, you know, they have like an ear thing, but it's not really an ear thing. It doesn't use the ear. So, you know, and then they have two arms. They may have a difference in terms of having four fingers or five fingers or, you know, even three fingers or something of that nature. They seemingly have two legs and feet. And the fact that they stand up and look straight ahead with their heads rotated like ours is, we are the only species on the planet that are bipedal. Okay, so the question becomes, are they us from a future time? And we at some point down the road come up with the capability of maneuvering through time and space. And obviously that our bodies have changed over many thousands of years, could be due to, you know, a whole bunch of things like, you know, for example, we are homogenizing our DNA because we are intermarrying amongst each other, and over a period of time, that could have a potential effect. And we have scientists and anthropologists that are looking into that. We've also been looking at the fact that you know, DNA. So if you look at them coming back into time and picking up people and possibly taking DNA, it could be that we're trying to salvage our future by now adding in DNA from the past, our time, trying to, you know, prevent some sort of an issue there.
Well, I mean, there's a myriad of possibilities, aren't there, once you start trying to extrapolate. You have sightings, you have pictures, you have video. So, you know, the rest you have to extrapolate. But we're very lucky in the society in that we have we have it all laid out for us. Do you have something else, Deborah, you could share with us?
Well, only that we are told that the more advanced you get, the more you're able to choose the body that will best suit the job that it's come to do. And we're told that there are some civilizations, not actually, I don't think it's in this galaxy, but are cat-like. So they in a cat format. And there's one of this beautiful story of something which is called like Heather Angel, and it's of this very advanced race of people that are actually cat-like. And when this civilization met one of the what we call the adepts, that was working in a Earth-based physical body with Dr. King here on Earth, but then could project and go to other parts. They had never, the cat, I wouldn't call them cat people, but that had never before seen humanoid shape. And when they were then, Heather Angel was the name that this female entity took. She was so taken with the capabilities of this shape. She said it was the most beautiful shape that she'd ever come across. And therefore, she actually changed her shape to humanoid, which I found like a fascinating. So at the more that you progress, you actually adapt to the environment that you need to be working within. We're also told that the protectors of the flame, so the flame of Earth, are very, very advanced beings, not from this planet. So they protect the flame of the Earth. And we're told that there are three of them. But they can make many shades, if you want. I'm just using the word shade, but many parts of themselves. So they can make parts of themselves project to do a job. So if you like, they can split their consciousness out to do a job. And the more that you read it, I mean, sometimes I read things and then I find myself like laughing, and not because it's like, it's laugh or gasp, you know, that sort of.
My science truth is further, it's stranger than science fiction.
Yeah, so what I think I'm saying is that there's many, that it can be as many shapes as you want to. And I'll finish on another story that we're told, that there was a race that came into our solar system. They needed a certain frequency of energy, which was on level 5 Earth. So we're told that there's different frequencies of around Earth, and they on level 5, which is a very high level. They needed that frequency, and they started to siphon it off. Now that was going to unbalance the whole of the Earth, because obviously everything's in, and the solar systems are all in balance. The intelligences from this solar system could not communicate with them. They weren't responding. And we were told that they were then escorted away before they could do any damage. But these entities were ant-like, 4 inches high, incredibly heavy, of a metalloid material, and could move at incredible speeds. Well, if you saw that on a science fiction, I'd probably flick over and watch something else, you know, because it just doesn't seem, it just seems too far away. But because I've studied the teachings and I trust and have tested the bits I can, so I have a trusted source that I've proven on the bits I can. I then, if you want, take the rest as well. Why would they tell me otherwise? You know, so it has to be, you know, there has to be the truth. I have some sort of benchmark, and if you like, the teachers for me are the benchmark. So I'm going to get somebody like yourself on, Rich, that then says things that line up with what I've read, or postulate things which I have read. It almost like gives me, I'm not the lady in the room that goes, oh, I saw that flying saucer. Not, oh, did I say that? No, I get bolder. I get bolder as I speak to more people that collaborate with what I believe to my core to be the truth. So I bless you for that.
Well, you're welcome, Deborah. I'm glad to be validating you. You know, to me, you know, you got to understand when I got started with this in that young kid, right? And I was running around chasing these things. My family and everybody else considered me to be pretty nutty, you know. I've got to be a kook, you know. Why would I do this, you know? Why would you waste your time doing that? And I pretty much kept at it because I was convinced that there was something to it, you know. It was worthwhile. There was meaning here, and I needed to keep up with that the best I could, you know. Over the years, they closed down Project Blue Book in 1969, and the National Academy of Sciences came out and said, yay, verily, there's nothing to it. Don't waste any time scientifically. Don't study this anymore. And they discouraged scientists from doing anything with it at all. I look at that, what happened from 1969 then up until about 2017, when they finally came out with the fact that there was an announcement, the fact that the government was actually doing something with this. I call that the dark ages, because that's almost like we were going back and saying, well, you can't study it. You know, you will reject your scientific papers if you do anything with it. You know, shut it down. Just go away. Don't even mention this subject. But what's happened since the 2017, and when the announcement was that they came out and said, well, we have been studying it. They had a secret project that was up there that was doing it. And they had videos that they had captured with Navy and, you know, military grade equipment. And they have three videos of these objects. I'm going like, wow. And so suddenly what's happened is we went from, you know, an organization of about maybe 40 people to 269 scientists that are all getting together and saying, I want to be a part of this. And so much like you're saying, you're being validated. I was being validated too. I mean, I've got family members saying, wait a minute, Rich wasn't a nut. You know, oh, wait a minute. He's actually on the mark, you know. What I would say to you is that, you know, even what George King was talking about in the early days has held true through time and is now getting to the point that it's suddenly being validated. Just today, I read an article where, believe it or not, we're starting to see that metals can heal themselves. So going back to your comment about being organic metal, right? Now, I mean, this is scientific study that they've come out with that said that today that they're finding out that aluminum, copper, and some of these other metals and stuff like that are able to, even if they have a crack, their atoms and things like that will come together and they will heal themselves. That's a whole level of change of thought. Our knowledge has gone crazy. But yet, you know, let's go back to that, you know, the organic metal that George King in the day was trying to describe, right?
Yeah.
He was trying to describe that he might have used the word organic, you know, because he was thinking about, well, it's like, you know, it's moldable, it's changeable, it's able to self-heal or something like that. You know, that's what I'm getting at. And so, I mean, science is continuing to advance. And every day I start to see more and more where, I mean, like the whole concept of the fact that we have in quantum physics, the notion of entanglement, where two particles can be separate by, you know, lots of miles, and one will change its spin at the same time the other one does. They're not even detached. And that's, you know, how are they communicating with each other? And that's beyond light speeds. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it just says that we are connected in many ways to each other and everything, right?
Because, yeah, I mean, you're trying to get the science into the UFO movement. We're trying to get the spirituality into science, because that's really what Dr. King was about. You're interested in the craft. We're more interested in the people driving the craft. These, you know, why are they here and what they came to teach? Dr. King said the silence group would... First, they would deny it. There would be this blackout, as you said. And then their second strategy is to say they're here to harm us. You know, are you seeing that as well?
We have an interesting situation where overall, if you look throughout the history, there's been a couple instances of where there appears to be harm intentions, but they're extremely rare. In in 1977 in Colares, Brazil, you had instances where objects were coming down and shooting like lights, beams at people and causing injuries. And even it's alleged people having death as a result of some of these. So you do have that element that's out there, right?
Would that have been the secret space program?
No, in 1977, these were, I mean, in fact, the intelligence agencies are going nuts trying to look into it more because it's fascinating. It's one of the very few cases of actual, you know, intent to harm by something we don't know what it was. We don't know these are just objects that are, and yet there are other objects that we have that are even natural phenomena. There's a phenomena called Earthlight phenomena. And it basically, it can be a ball of gas, if you would. Let me put it to you that way. Ball of gases that somehow ignites and lights up. And these are seen in the atmosphere. And a lot of people think of them as being alien spacecraft when they're just nothing more than a natural phenomena that we don't understand. And we haven't studied them well. So I spent 3 years going out to a site an hour away from me that's had them since 1973. And there are other parts of the world where these things are going on as well. Hesteland, Norway, you have the Minmin lights, you have the Marfa lights, Minmin lights are in Australia. The Marfa lights are, I believe, in Texas. There's the Brown Mountain lights over in the Carolinas. And then Cloverdale, Alabama, had these things as well. But they're really more prevalent than we think.
But they don't mean to harm us, that you would say that was to be a, if they wanted
they're not intelligent at all.
No, I mean the UAPs, I mean, on the.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that these balls of gas, when people have tried to, bump into it, touch them, they get like electric shock from them.
Okay.
So there's cases on record where people are, they're close proximity to the craft and they're harmed. But not by a repulsion. They're just electromagnetic discharge or something happened. Even the Travis Walton case in 1975.
Yeah, I was thinking of the Travis Walton case. Yeah, he ran towards the ship.
In that case, he no longer believes that they did it to him. He believes it was an accident, and they took him aboard the craft
right.
and kept him for observations. That. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's. His perception has changed about that whole encounter as well. Mm. But overall, they tend to be more, we tend to be the violent ones. We've shot at them. Yeah. We've attempted to do things to take them out of the sky. And that's my concern ultimately with the current trend, if you would, is we see them as a security threat. And now we're going to develop some sort of weapons to go and shoot them out of the sky or.
Well, it's an excuse to develop more weapons and to,
Precisely.
Yeah.
And let me also point out to you, Jack, I work at the DOD, right? And so we have an advancement going on with drone technology. The drones are, they got propellers on them and they can fly around. Some of them have different kinds of engines like the Predator and stuff like that. And they're being used, engaged. But there's a number of these drones that are coming into our perimeter of our defense agencies where we are, our stations. And we're concerned about them being our adversaries. So I'm helping to put out technologies that will detect them and we will be able to knock them out of the sky. And we will also know where the operator is that's controlling them. Okay, so that's all of our DOD facilities are all getting this kind of technology to where we can do that. And it's because our adversaries are also wanting to steal secrets and they are also being misidentified as UFOs. Okay, so not everything you hear from everybody about I saw a UFO is a UFO. The vast majority of these things, in my years of experience of investigating cases, the vast majority of people make misidentifications and mistakes.
Okay. Well, and what do you think they're here to do? I mean, there's so many sightings. I mean, what do you think they're doing? I mean, in the Ethereum Society, we think they're, you know, they're coming here to, I think of a parallel is the spiritualist movement in the 19th century that was all about psychic events and to raise our consciousness. And now there's this, all these UFO sightings. I think they're trying to raise our awareness that there is life on other worlds. It's a program, you know?
So the problem is that when you take a look at, you know, you try to interpret what the intent of an object is, right? When you see it in the sky, you're trying to assume, you know, and it thinks like you, to say, well, here's why it's over at this nuclear plant. We don't know why it's at that nuclear plant. And we like to think that we can somehow intuit, here's an unknown, that we can somehow interpret what an alien or some other kind of life form, and it could be multiple of these things, that we know how they think, what they think, and what their derived intent is. And we just don't know.
Well, the nuclear is, you pulled the one right out of the hat there, because that's a big thing they're worried about.
Yeah, that's a big thing. But now, okay, so, you know, many of us will look at the nuclear things. We see that there's a direct intent because they've been at our nuclear storage facilities. They've been at our nuclear production sites. They have visited our nuclear detonation sites. They've been at all of our nuclear kind of capabilities, our missile sites. They've deactivated missiles, 20 missiles up in Malmstrom. And there's been other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And Chernobyl, also, they were in disasters, places like that.
Yeah, so then you have even over in Bentwaters and a nuclear site over there. Well, it seemed like that they were trying to tell us to quit playing with nukes, right? But then on the other hand, in Russia, you had an instance where an object was up there and it actually started the nuclear event. So the question is, was that a mistake? Were they trying to send out, and so, or were they trying to start something? we don't know. You know, what is the reason for them to do that?
Well, considering we've come this close, you know, far from, we've had nuclear disasters and we've been so close to World War III, I would pretty much safe to say, even if I hadn't heard of the Aetherius Society, that they're doing a good job.
Yeah, well, I would too. I think that, you know, I don't understand why they just don't come down and say, okay, folks, quit playing with nukes. We've had it, you know, be a little bit more direct maybe, or something like that. Talk to world leaders or something, you know. I keep looking
karma,
at that,
you know,
like,
that's,
the day the earth stood still and waiting for them to land on the White House lawn and say, all right, quit playing around. I'm going to have Gort take over and knock out your stuff.
Stephen Gray says the same thing, that, you know, it's you're watching a trial. You know, I'm watching my baby trying to get the square block in the round hole, you know, and if I help him all the time, he's never going to learn. He's never going to get past this karmic point.
Right.
So that's the reason it's karma. Yeah.
So there we go. We're struggling with, you know, the fact that we're trying to figure something out that is often difficult for us to figure out. We're trying to get our arms around it. We finally are getting the technology pieces that have advanced to the point where we can actually detect them, see them, and maybe actually start to see what they look like in the ultraviolet ranges, in the infrared range. You know, so many people are taking photographs of them and they're all blurry, but that's in the visible range. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to get like the infrared, you know, videos from the military equipment. And we're starting to see that they don't heat up in the atmosphere. Well, that tells us something. If they're moving, I mean, if we look at a meteor coming in every night, we see it, you know, glowing. We see it, you know, leaving a trail in the atmosphere. And we say, well, why don't these things do it when they're moving faster?
So what would you most like to know if you could meet one of the pilots of these ships?
Well, I would certainly want to know where they're from. I would certainly want to know, you know, what's their purpose here. I would also be wanting to know, you know, why haven't you made more of an overt connection to talk with us or to exchange, you know, with somebody who can make the change? What is it you want to say? You know, what are you, you know, there's a part of me that says that there's a hypothesis that I've come up with. They've always been here. I call it the ABH, always been here hypothesis. In other words, they've been around here since mankind has been on the planet, right?
The Star of Bethlehem.
Yes, exactly. And so bottom line is that there we have a relationship with them. We've always had a relationship with them.
Yeah.
And why haven't we made a better relationship, more of a stronger connection? I mean, why are we now exchanging information and technology or whatever like that? Are we not ready for it? We're certainly, if you look at just on the evening news, you'll find out we're not too far away from being the apes. I mean, in terms of our societies, we're at war with each other. We're shooting and killing. We're destroying our own planet. We're doing all kinds of damage to everything. And, you know, and I mean, I go back to thinking like, well, you know, didn't Christ or everybody talk about love? I mean, what happened to love? Did we get rid of that? I mean, where's the notion of civility anymore? And it's, you know, I don't know that we're on a very positive trend in many respects. I think that, you know, science is one thing, and you know, like you're talking about bringing religion into science. I think that there's many of the scientists that we have that, you know, they do believe and are more open-minded than many. And they're starting to get more into accepting other kinds of things, where a lot of them that I knew in the early 60s were very much agnostic. You know, they you know, I'm sorry, if I don't have it in front of me, I don't believe it, you know, and that type thing, right? And, you know, I don't know, a little bit about me is that, first off, I told you I got into some pretty strange things and you know, ghosts, Bigfoot, the whole nine yards and stuff like that. And I realized early on that the world is not the way I necessarily thought it was, that there's a whole lot more to it that I need to be open to, right? So I became very open to that. My wife is a psychotherapist. She's trained in that, but she had a near-death experience. And so I got to experience that whole near-death experience side of things. And I've now looked into well over 500 cases of near-death experiences on my own. And you realize that, you know, there is something out there that, and it's very consistent, much like the UFO thing. You hear stories about, you know, I did this. I saw my body from above. I was in a tunnel, or I was, you know, it's, and you hear same that same kind repeating. Of consistency, yeah. Right? Same kind of consistency. And you say, well, wait a minute. You know, again, it's like one of those things where, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because we, again, just don't understand our universe and our role in it and who we are, really. We don't understand consciousness. You know, we don't understand how it is that you and I are talking right now, and I don't even know how I'm going to say it. My next sentence is automatically there, right? You know, it's like, where is the intelligence in me? It's in the gap between my sentences, right? Somewhere in there. And you know, and I think that that's where we struggle with trying to be able to come to, you know, to some person. How do we grasp this? And it's so difficult and it's so complex. But I think that we're getting more and more openness, understanding. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't even understand or accept UFOs, but now they start to do that, right? And now they're willing to believe it. Well, the next step is let's go to the next step.
Yeah. You're kind of a gateway drug for these scientists to, you know, because yeah. We're all to the left or the right. It's like politics. We're all to the left or the right. It's like, oh, I believe in this and that, and you. Oh, and I believe in much more than you. It's like, oh, yeah. So we're all on a scale, on a spectrum.
And the good thing that's happening right now is we have 260 basically science-minded people that are from every discipline. Mm. We have psychologists, we have medical people, we have physicists, and they're all talking to one another right now.
Yeah,
and they're
brilliant.
All, they're all collaborating and sharing and being open with each other. And now, and so that may help us change, right? That may help us advance their perspective to be more open and accepting. And I think that, you know, that over time, I think I'm encouraged by that can happen. I think that also science is advancing and changing that perspective in a sense that, you know, like, for example, whoever heard of metal healing, you know, or, you know, and so it's going to happen. It's just taking a long time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Keep up doing what you're doing, by the way.
Thank you. And likewise, how can people follow your work and keep track of you?
Bottom line is I'm on Facebook, I'm on, you know, Twitter, I'm on all these different things like that, social media. You know, if you do anything like, you know, you want to get a hold of me, we do have a contact page that's up and available on our SCU website. It's at www.explorescu.org. You know, and there's a place for contacts up there. We also publish our papers and put all of our papers, the scientific papers, they're all up on that website. We're trying to be as transparent as possible. So the Nimitz case that we looked at, the Aguadilla case, and all these other cases, they're all up there, and scientific papers are up there for anybody that wants to read them. And we have a quarterly newsletter that we put together. So feel free to, you know, to do that and connect with me that way. And then if somebody wants to engage me, you've got my email address. You can, you know, hand out and stuff like that as well. But I'm here to learn myself at the same time to share.
Well, that's wonderful. Exciting times. And yeah, must be a good time to be into UFOs.
It is. Well, anyway, all right. Good luck to you all.
Thank you. And if people want to learn more about the Aetherius Society, they can go to aetherius.org. Thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.